Coming up on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, we're talking about life tips from scientists with Garth Sundom. That's up next on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour.
Netcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with me, Dr. Kiki Sanford, episode 142, recorded on Thursday, May 3rd, 2012. Life hacking with science. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. I'm Dr. Kiki, and this is the show where you get to listen, sit back, relax for an entire hour, basically. Yeah, pretty much the better part of an hour. And just expose yourself to one area in the sciences. Now, today, it's a little bit different. I have one expert for 1 hour, and this expert actually went around and interviewed other experts to help you live your life better. That's right. How can you live your life a little bit better through science? This is all about science. And we are going to be speaking with the science writer and legendary geek, Garth Sundom, about his book, Brain Trust. So that's coming up in just a few. But first, as always, a few science headlines. It's May 3rd, 2012. And these are the science news stories that made headlines this week. Italian researchers published a study in the FASEB journal this week suggesting that an enzyme called 5-lipoxygenase plays an important role in aging. Samples of human immune cells called lymphocytes that were exposed to microgravity on the International Space Station had higher levels of the enzyme than samples exposed to Earth-like gravity. Additionally, the lymphocytes exposed to microgravity had increased apoptosis, or programmed cell suicide. The results imply that blocking 5-lipoxygenase might strengthen aging immune systems. It also might help save astronauts. Benefits, you know. The May 2nd issue of Nature magazine contains one of two highly contested papers studying the genetics and transmissibility of the H5N1 bird flu virus. The paper's publication was delayed due to concerns that the methods employed to create an artificial version of the virus could be used by bioterrorists. While controversial, the study clearly shows that a pandemic-causing bird flu only needs a couple of mutations to evolve from where it is right now and could easily jump from birds to mammals, whether in the lab or in nature. In a step toward broad-spectrum lasers, researchers have created an RGB laser using quantum dots. The dots, which are mini semiconductors, were specifically designed to emit light rather than heat and then layered as a film on a glass surface. Monochromatic laser light from a lab-grade laser then stimulated the dots to re-emit the light at the red, green, and blue wavelengths. However, don't expect these in your local store anytime soon. A paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences concludes that humans might still be evolving. The research used church records from the 18th to 19th centuries of a small, highly monogamous population in Finland and determined that there was enough variation in individual reproductive success or fitness to allow for the selection of traits that would increase survival. However, the study didn't actually measure any particular traits that might be selected for. Last week, researchers disproved the idea that iron-containing cells for magnetoreception exist in the beaks of birds. This week, a separate group of scientists identified cells in four regions of the bird brain that respond to magnetic field changes: the vestibular area in the brainstem, the hippocampus, the visual cortex, and the dorsal thalamus. Recordings from neurons in the vestibular region identified 53 neurons that encode the direction, intensity, and polarity of the magnetic field. Now that a brain system for the magnetic sense has been identified, the last piece of the puzzle is still the receptor. How is a magnetic field transmitted to the neurons in the brain? We know the answer is probably not in the beak. According to a study in the Canadian Journal of Zoology, you don't need to be concerned about polar bears drowning at sea. The study used GPS collars to track the movements of 52 female adult bears between 2004 and 2009 and found that they can swim long distances over periods of several days. Many bears made swims of at least 30 miles, with some averaging over 96 miles, and one individual as much as 220. Chinese paleontologists found fossilized remains of creatures that might have been ancestors to the modern flea. But instead of being tiny and adapted to feeding on warm-blooded animals, these ancient fleas were adapted to sucking blood from between the scales on dinosaurs. Pseudoplex jurassicus and Pseudoplex magnus were 10 times the size of a flea that you might find on your dog, with long claws and a needle-like proboscis. Let's just say I'm happy with our fleas, if I had to choose. No. A moon or a planetesimal? Analysis of Cassini spacecraft data on the Saturnian moon known as Phoebe suggests that it formed over 3 million years after the beginning of the solar system. Started as a spherical object like the Earth, has a differentiated interior of separate layers, and is denser than other moons. The study's authors argue that Phoebe probably formed in the Kuiper Belt, like Pluto, and fell inward toward the sun until it was captured by Saturn's gravity. Nature reports that the Pan-STARRS 1 galaxy survey spotted a flare of visible light and ultraviolet light from the center of a galaxy. Researchers then determined that they couldn't find anything at the location of the flare. That, along with the other factors, allowed the determination that the flare was actually a red giant star being torn to bits by a supermassive black hole. Astronomers estimate that such an event occurs once per galaxy per 10,000 years. This was the third such event ever witnessed by man. And that does it for the science headlines this week. Let me know what you think about these science news stories, or tell me what you think should be news by emailing Dr. Kiki at drkiki.tv, or leave me a voicemail at 650-741-5454. This episode of Dr. Kiki Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which means that you save time, money, and hassle. There are several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and TV shows on your home computer, your Mac, PC, your laptop, even. An iPad works if you have an iPad app, your iPhone with an iPhone app, and some Android phones will work as well. If you have a gaming console, like an Xbox 360, a PS3, or a Nintendo Wii, you can watch Netflix right on your TV using one of those devices. If you're not a gamer, you can watch Netflix on your TV with an Apple TV or a Roku box. They're inexpensive and very easy to use. With Netflix, you can watch movies and TV shows instantly using any of these devices, and you can begin watching a show or a movie on one device, and if you get interrupted, stop it at any point, and then pick it up where you left off on another device. It's seamless. Whichever way you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies and shows as you want, anytime you want, and you can cancel at any time. Try Netflix today for 30 days. Free. Go to netflix.com/twit. Be sure to use this URL when you sign up for your free trial. It's netflix.com/twit. We thank Netflix for their support of Twit and Dr. Kiki Science Hour, and we hope that you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. Now it's time, that part of the Dr. Kiki Science Hour, that we actually bring in the guest and start talking. Let's talk about some science. And so our guest today, from his website, Garth Sundom is a TED speaker, a puzzle master at Wired's Geek Dad blog, a wipeout competitor and loser, He didn't win on that one. Contributor to the Science Channel, blogger, dad, and sometimes a rock climber. His work at the intersection of science, math, humor, and geek culture includes a growing list of best-selling books, as well as articles for the New York Times, Wired, Esquire, Maxim, Congressional Quarterly, Sky and Telescope, and many more. He also writes science news for the University of Colorado Cancer Center, and his most recent book is Brain Trust. Garth, thanks for joining us on the show today. I can't hear him.
I'm here. I'm there. Here. Hello.
Excellent. Now I hear you.
There we go.
So I'm really glad to get you back on the show. The last time that you were joined me on the show, we had a lot of fun talking about the brain and neat psychological things that occur in the brain and the geekiness of our heads. But this time around, you've gone around and you've solicited advice or tips from scientists. How did
you
about this?
130 Nobel, MacArthur, and National Medal of Science winners. And I asked them what we should do to live the scientifically perfect lives. I'm also swimming in Labradors right now, as you can probably tell. But I think if I'd had any inkling what a pain in the neck it was going to be to interview 130 scientists in 6 months, I'm not sure I ever would have written the book proposal. But it turned out, you know, you can't get this stuff from papers. You can't get this stuff from abstracts. You got to call these people up and figure out what they had to say. I learned how to, you know, the optimal angle to shoot a basketball. I learned how to scam-proof yourself. I learned to only eat for 8 hours a day and how to take a corner, how to bet better, how to surf. It's been quite a 6 months.
In any of the interviews, last time I remember you when you talked to scientists, it was a lot of interviews via phone. Did you go talk to people in person? Did you learning how to surf? Was that something you actually got to go do and get an in-person lesson?
You know, check this out. So up by you, I have a college friend. So a ringer of mine runs an entomology lab up at Davis. So I went up and chatted with Louie about how to grow huge carnivorous plants. He was up hiking in the Sierra and found that, you know, in this population, in the high Sierra fens where there's very poor soil, the plants have evolved to get their nutrients by, you know, eating the flesh of the living, as it were. So Louis found that the plant growing next to the pile of deer dung was the largest plant. There is a pattern by which you can fertilize a carnivorous plant's roots and then fertilize its flesh-catching apparatus that sparks that plant to grow extremely large. And I got to hang out with Louis in his lab and figure it out. But the thing is, okay, so you go hang out with these people, and there's Louis slitting open 10,000 cigar-shaped insect traps. And he's literally, like, slitting these 10,000 traps open, and he's looking at them under the microscope. And I asked Louis, you know, aren't there, like, people for those things? Don't you have, like, grad students or people who can do those so you can be designing more experiments? And Louis said that, no, he has to have his fingers in the data gathering in order to generate his next questions. And In my experience, all of these scientists that I talk to, their science somehow comes from their lives. You know, it has to be a messy experience of getting in there with the data, getting in there with the gathering, in order to generate these questions that they're asking. I hope Louis is finally done with his 10,000 insect traps. If you're watching,
I'd love to know what kind of question the next scientific question came out of opening those insect traps. You know, if there was a moment of inspiration.
Why am I doing this? How did my life come to this? Oh, you know, and if people, I think if they unfocus their eyes, we have conflicting stripes, so we're sort of stereoscopic, and it'll be 3D if people look at both of us at the same time. It'll be good.
Just everyone, unfocus your eyes, go a little cross-eyed. Next time we have, right, the double box. There we go. Okay, so in the book, as I'm piecing through it, one of the tips here, and I wonder if this came out of the researcher's life, How to get your spouse to do more housework. Okay. And I am curious about this one.
So I bet you are. I am as well. Berkeley economist George Akerlof won a Nobel for his paper. What exactly is it called? It's the Lemons paper, and it shows that because you can never tell who has what information, that a used car will slip, the price of a used car will slip towards an assumed minimum. But what he's been writing about lately is something that he calls, and his co-author Rachel Cranton call, identity economics. And basically, it's an economic way to explain why the exact two same people will act differently, why two people will act differently in the same situation with the same presumed payoffs. He chalks this up to identity. Organizations create identity. Schools create identity. The military creates identity. We hold within us many identities. You know, you may have the identity of an author and a radio host and a TED speaker and whatnot. And in various situations, if you act counter to your identity, you pay an identity price. This finding comes out of trying to explain why, even when the female member of a household does all of the outside work, she still does the majority of the housework. It's because the identity of red-blooded American male, however much a guy buys into it, forces him to pay an identity penalty when he does housework. There are ways to avoid a red-blooded American male incurring an identity penalty for doing housework. One of them is to align housework with the male identity, perhaps throwing your clothes in the hamper as opposed to near the hamper is like hitting that three-point shot, or maybe loading the dishwasher requires manly spatial skills that only he possesses.
Right.
Or you can actually try to change identity, and that's a whole another scientific story. But the more you align desired behavior with identity, the more able someone is to perform that behavior without incurring an identity penalty.
That's really interesting. That would happen a lot more easily than actually changing somebody's identity. And partners in people in relationships will very often complain of their other partner. I'm not going to say man or woman because it happens in all sexes, regardless of the type of relationship you're in. There's usually somebody in the relationship who carries the burden of the housework and someone else who doesn't. And you try and change the other person.
Yeah, it's much easier to do more situation than it is to change a person. And I talked to social psychologists about how to create change. So check this out. This is cool. This one's not super practical, but it was one of the neatest people I talked to. Simon Levin at Princeton makes mathematical models of fish schools. So he'll give, fish schools in his mathematical model a percentage leader or a percentage follower, and he'll make connections within this fish school, and then he'll flip a fish, and he'll watch how the change propagates through the group. Now, that's what he used to do. What he does now is he uses these same models to show how groups of humans change opinions. And groups of humans change opinions the same way that a school of fish changes direction, which is very cool.
So if one leader fish changes direction, then everyone else will start changing direction.
Well, it depends on the network structure. So yeah. So he looks at how aberrant behaviors can become a social norm. He looked at how the caste system of India changes. He looked at, how the necktie became adopted. And I wrote about how the aberrant behavior of skating a dry swimming pool started out in Venice Beach. Dogtown and Z Boys popularized it and was able, you go to any suburban skate park now and there are dry swimming pools. You need something called a distributed network, which is the opposite of a well-mixed network, blah, 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 blah. But a distributed network allows far-flung nodes to not be very well connected. So an aberrant behavior can, you know, as Bob Marley's saying, can, you know, grow before the sheriff kills it. That was Venice Beach in the 70s. You need an initial buy-in by people to coalesce around this. You know, that was Z Boys in Dogtown. And then you need network connectivity, which they got the 1975 Del Mar Nationals when Skateboarding Magazine covered Z Boys and all of a sudden gave them direct domino-like connection to the rest of the network, which allowed behavior that had coalesced. It gave it the connectivity that it needed to flow through the rest of the country, the rest of the network that was the country. Mm-hmm. So it was very specific conditions that allowed this behavior, this aberrant behavior, to become a social norm.
And along those lines, maybe we're even starting to see that with geekery.
This is the connection. Kiki, you're the connection. I'm in the far-flung node of the distributed network in Boulder, Colorado. And you are a Skateboarding Magazine, Kiki.
That's right. There we go. I am that flow-through network that will allow the distribution of geekery to the rest of the world.
Oh, same model. I talked to guys at the London School of Economics who looked at how the information of a soccer ball flows through the network of a team. Mm-hmm. And this was in the 2010 World Cup. So they were looking at what network features may have allowed different teams to do better or do worse. And they found on the Dutch team, they found an extremely high centrality to Arjen Robben, the Dutch number 10. What did he play? Is he striker? Yeah. Meaning that everything went through him. All the information in this network that was the Dutch team went through Arjen Robben. So when the Spanish marked Arjen Robben very closely, they disrupted the flow of information through the entire network that was the Dutch team. That's
right.
So cool.
Just watch that guy. Whatever he does.
Yeah. Don't let him do it.
Don't let him do it. And then, yeah. And then if you don't have a backup plan, then the network would be completely disrupted.
Yeah. Whereas the Spanish didn't have anybody with high centrality. They right. had, you know, a nice even flow of information through their entire network. So you remove one node and it really didn't do anything. Like they can pass the ball any way through their network, whereas the Dutch could only go through Arjen Robben.
Along these lines, there's another section in your book that I could find very useful, how to create a cult-like posse of worshipful automatons.
Yeah. So I talked to Eli Berman down at UCSD, who wrote a fascinating book called The Economics of Terrorism. It's about the economics of terrorism. And anyway, so he looked at the features of the top five terrorist organizations and tried to figure out how they had become the top five terrorist organizations. So he looked at Hamas and Hezbollah, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, the Girl Scouts, a couple more. Well, wait,
the
one of
Girl
those.
Scouts?
No, I'm kidding. It wasn't the Girl Scouts. And he found a couple of things that they had done to become very successful. First, they grew out of organizations that had started as mutual aid organizations. So if you're in a society that does not provide aid in a governmental way, there are organizations that will take the place of governmental aid. You know, they'll rebuild your house when it falls down. They'll provide food and water. All of these successful terrorist organizations started as mutual aid societies. Now, everybody wanted things from these mutual aid societies, and resources were limited. You can't just give out food and water and money and construction aid. So they had to become selective. They had to create initiation rites. And what Berman looked at and found is that the utility that someone loses through one of these initiation rites, they are so extreme in terms of utility cost that they outweigh any possible future utility gain a terrorist could get by defecting later. So the Hell's Angels, you wear your leathers and are urinated on by the rest of your group, and then you have to wear these leathers for a month. that initiation rite outweighs any possible gain of later defection. If you have a stout initiation rite, you can grow defection-proof worshipful automatons, economically speaking.
Nice. So is that something like fraternity hazing?
Fraternity hazing. And there was this group, the Toronto 13, that kind of were wannabe terrorists, and they played soccer together and, you know, did things like plotted the beheading of the Canadian prime minister. But they had no initiation rite. So they had not proofed themselves against, you know, snitches. You know, they kind of like anybody who wanted to join could join. And it wasn't just, you know, if they had had the police plant, if they had subjected that plant to a stout initiation rite, there's a very good chance that that plant would not have made it through the initiation rite and thus been able to snitch. The payoff wouldn't have been good.
It's about this. This is about payoffs and costs and benefits. There's a lot in the book about like human behavior and what you can do to change. It's pretty much changing human behavior, but not all of the researchers that you interviewed study people. How can you get how do you make the jump from a lot of, say, the fish research or entomology research to to the people life advice?
Well, I try not to, first of all. I think that, obviously animal research in large part is more applicable to animals than it is to humans. So a lot of times when I was interviewing people about spider silk or about, the chemicals of love in a monkey brain or a vole brain, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, or binge eating monkeys, I think that a lot of those findings best stay in the animal in which they're studied. But here's a cool sort of health-related human behavior finding. I talked to Sachin Panda down at Salk Institute, and he found that even with calories kept constant, you are better off condensing the time you eat every day to 8 hours a day. And, you know, it doesn't have to do with calories. It has to do with the function of mitochondria in your liver. If they work, if you eat, they work. And if they work while they're dividing, they have a higher rate of DNA damage. By eating for only 8 hours a day, you can let your mitochondria rest and you are at lower risk for things like diabetes and all sorts of metabolic badness. I like that for human behavior. Not that I can do it. I've tried.
So basically going between like 8 a.m. and 6 p.m. or that'd be right?
Eight to four.
There we go. Get the clock math right. Like 8 to 4 p.m. So when we eat, we don't eat for 8 hours. I mean, a lot of people will like take 20 minutes to get a meal in. You know, it's not eat for 8 hours. It is just within 8 hours, spread all your eating out and don't eat outside of that.
What we need is a defined period of fasting. And that, a defined 16-hour period of fasting. What Panda looked at is we are optimized for our evolutionary past in which we didn't have electricity. So we were effectively required or we were limited to eating for only 8 hours a day. You know, you got up in the morning and it took a little while to get your food. And then at night, you would want to be done eating while it was light. So in our evolutionary past, in our long evolutionary past, we ate for 8 hours a day. And so our mitochondria, or we ate for only 8 hours a day. So our mitochondria became optimized to that schedule. Now, when you do things like, you know, the nighttime NASA lights map, there's this map that shows where lights are on in the U.S. And it is the same, it overlays almost exactly with the U.S. incidence of diabetes map, which is kind of a fascinating correlation. I mean, that's a correlation. I don't want to say that that's science, but it's cool to look at. The mitochondria thing's a lot more solid.
It's an interesting idea, and people have really, you know, talked about, people do have occasional fasts. They talk about the benefits of fasting, even though I don't know that those have been really empirically proven at this point in time, many fasts at least. But this idea of using our physiology and the way that the energy producing aspects of our liver cells, how they work and how they've evolved to work to our advantage might be. That's a really interesting idea.
I have no idea about periodic fasts. Although I tried it once, and I don't think I'll ever. That's what I did in Bell, California. So it was sort of like the thing to do. You know, you drink some sort of guava juice for the weekend. No, right. I've never.
Juice fast, you end up kind of cranky and lightheaded for most of the time. Yeah, I don't know about that stuff. Okay, you interviewed 130 scientists.
130 plus, and I cut it down to 93.
That's what I was gonna ask. Only 93 in the book. So, who missed the cut? Ooh. What was one of the best stories or best tips that you were like, should include this?
I had some amazing conversations that I just couldn't. Oh man, that I just couldn't make practical. And okay, first of all, let me 1,000% affirm my commitment to non-usable exploratory science. The hook of the book is you can use it. There's 93 things that you can do that are cool. But I talk to people like David Eagleman, who I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
And I talked to him about time perception mostly. I mean, he wrote the book about the afterlife, but I talked to him about experiments. You know, he takes people up on towers, puts a watch on their wrist, chucks them off the tower, you know, presumably into some sort of net, but I don't think he ever stated that for sure. But he asked them then about their perception of time. Was it fast? Was it slow? Fascinating conversation. I must have talked to him for 45 minutes. And I just couldn't get it in the book. And I'm so, so sorry. I mean, I hate to miss that in favor of the optimal angle to shoot a basketball. Okay. Let me tell you about right. that. Okay.
So absolutely understand. But now that you get there, what is the optimal angle?
This is cool. So check this out. You know, everybody knows that the more straight down basketball goes towards the hoop, the larger the hoop looks. You know, if you come in at an angle, there's like a lower... there's a smaller angle of entry to the hoop. So you want to come straight down. But error is magnified over distance. So the higher you shoot the ball, the longer your overall arc, and the more a small error can hurt you. So to balance these two out, was it John Fontanella at the Naval Institute? I talked to a couple guys up there. Anyway, he found that the optimal angle to shoot a basketball. Okay, oh, we got video. So, okay, imagine, mirror image here. This is going to be hard. Here's the hoop. And here is your hand shooting the basketball. There's an angle that connects your hand to the basket, right? And as you move your hand out past the three-point line, that angle gets shallow. And as you move your hand right underneath the hoop, that angle gets very steep. The optimal angle to shoot a basketball is 45 degrees plus half the angle that connects your fingers to the hoop. So shallower far out and steeper close in, and it balances the twin desires of a short overall path and a steep approach.
And while logically that might make sense, while you're actually playing basketball, it's the practice and the repetitive learning experiences that your motor cortex goes through that actually lets your body calculate that, hopefully, on the fly.
And that's the optimal angle for a ball to go in the hoop. But I'm sure that for every ball player, they've practiced differently. And it would be interesting to look at, like, forcing someone to stray from what they've practiced in order to be optimal. I wonder if being optimal would outweigh practice, or if practice would outweigh being optimal. Now that would be cool.
That's a really interesting question. Go find somebody to study that. Yeah. Quick, somebody, we want to know. Another part of the book that I find absolutely interesting, because I try and teach a bit in what I'm doing here, talking to people, trying to translate scientific information. The other side of the equation is for the audience, and it's important for people to learn. And so you have a tip on how to learn in here.
Yeah, Robert Bjork at, is he UCLA or USC? Are you looking at the page? I'm not.
He is UCLA.
Awesome. So Robert Bjork is a venerable scientist in the field of learning and memory. Okay, oh, here's something we can all do at home. This is a test. Okay, so raise your hand at home if you took notes during class. Okay, now raise your hand if you had one study location that you like to go to, you know, your dorm room or a nook in the library to study. Raise your hand if you crammed before tests. And also raise your hand if when you sat down to study, you studied one material until you had it and then went on to the next. Okay, so according to Bjork, all of these strategies are exactly wrong for learning. He talks about it in terms of tennis. Well, so first of all, it's exactly wrong.
I could have done so much better.
I know. Our lives could have been so much different, Kiki, if we had only learned. But okay, so he said that if you take notes during class, you're getting into what he calls court stenographer mode, where you're just copying. Instead, he recommends taking notes just after class. By forcing yourself to recall the material, you strengthen the material. This seems hard to believe for those of us who went through engineering physics, but taking notes just after class will strengthen the material. He also recommends something called interleaving. In tennis, you could spend 2 hours working on your serve, and you would make an appreciable gain in those 2 hours. But if you interleave skills like your forehand, your backhand, your volley, your serve, your footwork, over time, the sum of the almost imperceptible gains you would make by interleaving is greater than the sum of the gains you make by focused sessions. So if you can put an umbrella over skills, I mean, if you're learning tennis, you wouldn't want to do, you know, synchronized swimming and Texas.
So jump in the pool, go back on the court.
But if you can draw an umbrella over topics and then hit each of them in a study session and interleave them, seeding these topics within related information makes you learn them more than focused study. The other tips, you know, I know in college my friends and I may have experimented with state-dependent study. So, you know, if you'd had a couple of beers while you were studying, you should have a couple of beers for the test.
When you take the test, right.
Exactly. It's the same thing with place. And I think people already know this one. If you learn something somewhere, you remember something somewhere. So if you learn only in your dorm room, you will remember best in your dorm room. If you want to remember everywhere, you've got to vary your study location.
So that information that actually makes a lot of sense coming from just the way the brain accesses information and brings it back, how environmental factors can trigger memories. And when you remember something, you are basically living it over again in your brain.
And we remember things in relation to other things. You know, people talk a lot about the sort of file drawer theory of memory, where you search through your memory until you find a very specific file drawer and you open it. That's partly true, but more so than that, we have webs of memory. And the way we remember something is very interconnected with how we seat that memory in these webs. So by interleaving things, you more effectively seat information within related information instead of trying to make distinct file drawers, which actually makes it a lot harder to remember.
All right. So from this book, what was your favorite tip?
Oh no, don't do that. there's so many. You know what? I get sucked into the fun of science. There's so many. So, I mean, the card trick, Ian Stewart's card trick in there that depends on odd and even numbers is like totally cool. The fact that only 2% of all of us can effectively multitask with David Strayer at Utah. These people are structurally different in their brains than people who can't multitask. He calls them supertaskers. Totally fascinating. How to scam-proof yourself with poor Dr. Greenspan, whose mother tricked him into marriage and the topic of gullibility. Rotational mechanics to make your malfunctioning cat land on its feet. The mathematics of synchronicity. Stephen Strogatz at Cornell, who you probably know. He does crickets and fireflies and looked at why the Millennium Bridge almost shook itself into the Thames on opening day. I can't pick one. You know why you should brake before hitting a corner? Because friction is a finite resource, and you want to spend it on turning and not on slowing down. I mean, how the mathematics of the traveling salesman problem can help you schedule your day's errands, you know, hitting points on a grid with the shortest possible tour. If there's anything that I came away with after interviewing 130 scientists and nearly driving me and my family completely batty, is that science is not a chore. It is just frickin' fun. It is a way to problem solve and hack the world, and it is fascinating, and it is just fun.
How much of what you came away with have you actually integrated into your own life?
I'm building world record paper airplanes. I mean, okay.
Every day. I'm breaking Guinness Book of World Records every day.
Not at all. I don't have the throw for that. But I've built the airplane. I've tried that 8-hour eating thing. What else have I done that's really good? Oh, man, I played the lottery with Skip Garibaldi's. He's an Emory mathematician. Remember when Garrett Lisi, the mathematician, came out with that theory of everything inside of E8?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, so Skip's the guy who disproved him. I'm sorry, you know, I kind of like that theory, but it didn't work out. Skip shows how to get a positive expected rate of return on your lottery dollar. Obviously, if a lottery drawing is random, you cannot do anything to increase your chances of winning, but you can increase your chances of winning alone. And you know, with that, there's a smaller chance of having to split the pot with someone, and it makes the pot look mathematically bigger. So picking unpopular numbers, like don't pick number 11, 13, 7, 17, pick unpopular numbers like 26 and... Oh, what are they? They're in the book. 46, I think, was unpopular.
And suddenly they're going to become popular.
Oh, it's the Heisenberg thing. We just tried to measure it and so blew our positions. Or whatever. And you know, the big lotteries, the Powerball, the Mega Millions, are never, ever a good bet. They have an expected rate of return of about 33 cents on your dollar. But state lotteries can roll over a couple times without getting huge publicity and generating rabid ticket sales. So you can have a high pot relative to the number of ticket sales. You can play unpopular numbers. And statistically, you can get a positive expected rate of return on your lottery dollar, which is kind of cool.
Statistically, has to be couched in the fact that it's not going to be every time.
Oh, dude. And the thing is, he also looked at portfolio theory to look at, you know, so you can make it a good bet. Is it ever a good investment? Mm. And unfortunately, it is never a good investment because the risk is so extreme that your chance of running out of money before your bet ever pays off is too great to ever justify that lottery dollar. So it can be a good bet, but it is never a good investment.
Investment.
Unless you look behavioral economically And what else do you get from your lottery dollar? The feeling of being rich for that time when you are yearning for the numbers to come up? If that's worth it to you, then that's another version of worth. Worth is an interesting topic.
Worth is very relative. It all depends on what a person's current perspective actually is.
Check this out. I talked to Paul Bloom at Yale about how information can substitute for price in the enjoyment we get out of a bottle of wine. So everybody knows that two bottles of wine, they're the same wine. You put a higher price on one and people like the higher price one more. Everybody knows that, right?
Yeah.
Because price is a signal. Price is a signal of quality. It's a signal that people before you valued this wine. It's like their vote. Now, you can add that same value to a bottle of wine by knowing about that bottle of wine. If you know the vintner, you know the year, things about the wine, how to taste it. People with added information value a wine as much as if it were priced higher. So if you want to get more out of your vacation, you want to get more out of your wine, you want
spend
to get
more on it.
Much is the scream. No more, and you won't have to spend more.
I love that. There's one thing from your blog you bring up, and I know this is something out of the book as well, but you blogged a while back about the rational irrationality of Egyptian soccer deaths. And can you talk a little bit about how, you know, things that seem so irrational, you know, a home team wins or loses and people riot and people die. How is that rational in any way?
So I talked to Gordon Dahl, who's another UCSD economist, San Diego. And he did a wonderful, terrible natural experiment. He looked at this data set on NFL games and domestic violence. And he found that when a favored home team loses, the rate of domestic violence in that home city spikes. And you can see it start to rise as a loss, as a favored home team loss sort of becomes inevitable in the fourth quarter. And it peaks like an hour after the game. And then it sort of subsides like 3 hours after the game. What he found, though, so check this out. It's if a home team underdog loses, then there's no spike in domestic violence. It's not the loss. It's our expectations. When our expectations are violated, we, you know, in his study, we become violent. So it's not necessarily objectively what happens in the world. It's what we expect to happen compared to what does happen. And, you know, he also looks at the economic payoffs of going to a new restaurant and shows that economically speaking, he can model why people get stuck in a restaurant rut. Because if your expectations, you know, if you go to a new restaurant and you have high expectations and those expectations are broken, that can outweigh the gain of having your expectations exceeded. So the downside of going to a new restaurant in terms of utility can be greater than the payoff of having your expectations exceeded at a good restaurant. So instead of experimenting with new restaurants, we just get stuck in the same rut of our same old restaurants because the utility works out best that way.
Right. I know what I'm going to get. I'm just going to stay with this. I know it's good.
You're not going to have the home team. You're not going to have a favored home team loss and end up with crushed expectations, which unfortunately NFL fans express with domestic violence.
And, you know, foodies express with, you know, throwing pies. But
that's the thing. You know, it's so funny. Like, so, talking to Nobel winners about economics, I'm talking to, you know, MacArthur winners about, you know, Louis von Ahn about how to, you know, put excess intellectual time to better use and whatever. But, you know, again, it's so interesting that this very high level, speculative, exploratory, fascinating science actually does filter down to, you know, how to make your cat land on its feet and how to do a really cool card trick with the properties, you know, of odd and even numbers. And I was surprised, you know, sometimes I would go into a conversation with someone thinking, this is fascinating. I'm just going to hear about it, but there's no way I'm going to be able to get this into my book because it's just not practical. But it would trickle down into, you know, there's this flock of pigeons that flies over the gas station by my house every night. And, you know, I noticed that if one pigeon splinters off towards a roost, nobody goes with that pigeon and the pigeon ends up, you know, flying back into the flock. But like mm-hmm. if four pigeons split off, then all of a sudden you have enough of a majority to pull the group depending on where the pigeon is in the flock. And, you know, Michael Kearns looks at this at Penn. You know, he puts undergrads in a room, puts walls between them, and then pulls out certain walls to create site connectivity. And then he plays coordination games where, you know, people have a red and a blue side to a card. And if they can all coordinate on red in the course of 2 minutes, then they all get paid. And if they can coordinate on blue in the course of 2 minutes, they all get paid. What network structure allows them to get paid? Well, a connected small minority, a highly connected small minority will dominate Kearns' room every time, and it's the same as the gosh darn flock of pigeons that flies around the gas station by my house. And it's the same as political primaries.
Yeah, so I remember there was a study, and it's probably current via Kearns or someone related to his work. I think last year or near the beginning of this year that suggested that small minorities, that you only need something like a 10% minority to actually sway political opinion.
Yeah, totally. And he would give them varying payoffs. So like some people would have a 50 cent payoff for red, but a $2 payoff for blue. And if only a couple blue people in this room were very highly connected, like you remove the walls around them so they could see the, you know, I don't know if it was four or six or eight slots around them, but a small connected minority could get the entire group to flip to blue, even if it wasn't their highest payoff. But it trickles down. And, you know, these amazing Nobel discoveries actually mean something about these pigeons by my house.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, they actually mean something about decisions that we end up making or opinions that we end up having about our democracy, about events that are occurring. You are, you know, you are into these tidbits of information, and in past books you've had tricks and little factoids, and one of the things you are very known for are your equations. Is there a lot to do with equations in this book? Do you revisit anything?
Oh dear, Kiki, you're leading me by the nose, and you know where we're going with this, because it's gotta be time for celebrity marriage.
Oh, right. Man.
So in 2005, John Tierney at the New York Times and I, with my harebrained math and his writing skills, put together an equation to predict the duration of a celebrity marriage. Now, we just updated it here in 2012 to see if the thing actually worked. And I am pleased and horrified to report that with five factors, it is very possible to predict the duration of a celebrity marriage. And it baffles me how, I hate to say it, but it's pretty horribly accurate. You can draw a pretty nice curve through a scatter plot of historical celebrity marriage data to predict future celebrity marriage outcomes with the factors of their combined ages at time of marriage, which you would expect, the months that they spent dating before they got married, which you would expect. Of her first five, of the wife's first five Google image hits, how many of those Google image hits show her in skimpy clothing? I know. And the ratio of her mentions in the New York Times compared to her mentions in the Inquirer, which I call her fame. It's not just that you're famous that predicts long or short celebrity marriage. It is the flavor of the wife's fame. Now, interestingly, I looked at all these factors for the guy, and I looked at a ton more factors that didn't pan out. You know, you got to find the stuff that actually correlates. But there's almost nothing that correlates for the dude. Like, we have almost no power to predict the duration of a celebrity marriage. It is almost all, at least in the factors I looked at, it is almost all the female stats that predict the duration of a celebrity marriage.
For whatever I think reason. That's fascinating. Yeah. I mean, you can hypothesize about all sorts of, you know, cultural or psychological reasons, things that would lead to the woman leading the divorce rate, I guess.
Or I don't know. I mean, so first of all, that is for, wow, I'm willing to shoot my mouth off. Of course I have speculations, but I have no idea. All I know is that it does. So you look at the historical data, you find the correlations, you know, you brainstorm all these factors. I looked at things like, let's see, what didn't pan out? The number of tattoos in their Google image hits didn't predict the rate of celebrity divorce. Number of previous marriages didn't correlate. Kids didn't correlate. Oh, Kevin Bacon number. I looked at people's Kevin Bacon.
What's your degree of Kevin Bacon?
My degree, I don't know, actually, probably 3 or 4. But a lot of people, like I was hypothesizing that real Hollywood insiders would have low Kevin Bacon numbers. You can Google that if you don't know what it is. And would have high divorce rates. That's not the case. But we narrowed it down to these five factors that actually allow you to draw a very accurate curve through celebrity marriage. Oh, and check this out. So Brangelina.
Yes.
Because we've got to go there, right?
Everybody wants to know.
If Brangelina had gotten married right after the Aniston split, the equation would have given them a 1% chance of making it 15 years. Oh, yeah. Excellent. Yeah. So and now Brangelina, because it or they, however you want to label it, has waited, the math predicts they have a 51% chance of making 15 years. Her Google image hits are much more cocktail dress than lingerie now. She has gotten a lot more legit press, so the flavor of her fame has gotten better these past 5 years. They are a little bit older, and they've dated for a lot, you know, longer, obviously. These factors predict a fairly good chance now for Brangelina, and they would have had a bad chance then.
That's really interesting. I mean, and then, you know, it does make sense in a certain way. Like you mentioned, her instead of her fame being as a result of, more pop culture type things that she'd be trying to do, movies, lingerie spreads in magazines that would gather her a lot more male attention from fans or would change that. She's doing a lot of humanitarian work. She's doing a lot of things that are maybe more, more consistent.
Or legit? Or
legitimate, yeah. Not that anything is illegitimate.
Illegitimate, yeah. I know that it works. You can lay this formula on, you know, we can get into this mathematical
model. Did you look at J-Lo?
Oh man, the many marriages of J-Lo. I'd have to pull up my spreadsheet if you want to get specific. But yeah, like her marriage to Johnny Noah, her waiter guy that she had known for 4 months or whatever, was one of the baseline low points of celebrity marriage that allowed me to pull out factors that correlate with bad marriages. But you know what? Okay, so you can do this. And you can draw a curve through this scatter plot, and it does pretty well. You know, you try to like get as close to as many people as possible, and invariably you miss some. You want to hear who my black swan is?
Yes.
Oh, I know. I know we all do. Lamar Odom and Khloe Kardashian, the flavor of famous tabloid fame. They're young. They didn't date very long. Man, oh man, they are still going.
Yeah, they shouldn't be, right? According to your equation, they shouldn't be.
Man, defying the laws of man, nature, and mathematics, they are still together. It's my black swan.
They're one of the outliers, and as we know, statistically, when you collect data to try and fit a curve, there are very often outliers.
And this, yes,
yeah,
and good for them.
I think there's always very, this is like an interesting teaching moment in sense that when you're creating an equation, you're modeling some idea. So this idea of being able to predict people's marriage longevity, you've created an equation, you have factors that go into it, and you've looked at each of these factors to see how they correlate and see how they change the ability of the equation to work. But even though you've done that, it's not going to be completely perfect. And in nature, when you go out into nature to try and collect the data to fit it, to see how your equation works, you're always going to find those outliers because nature can't be predicted.
Sometimes nature don't give it up. You know, like if you don't find those factors that correlate, you're kind of up the creek. You know, I got lucky to find strong correlations with Google image hits and skimpy clothing and the flavor of her fame, whatever. Like, you don't find these correlations, you ain't got no equation. So that's another. I mean, you can get into situations where I've tried and failed, like trying to predict Hollywood flops. I tried to, you know, see if like by looking at 50 historical Hollywood flops, if you could mine it for factors that would correlate to the point where you could predict future flops. And so far I ain't found it. Ooh, we're going to have a cameo, but my guy's coming back from gymnastics here.
Awesome.
Girls are coming in.
My kid and the babysitter just got back also. So we have dueling kids in the background.
Awesome. Which is mostly what I'm writing about these days is like a geek dad. At Wired's Geek Dad, I wrote about this study, like fatherhood decreases testosterone in men. I'm sure you probably saw this and how to choose an elementary school by the numbers. Can you do that? Mm-hmm. And you know the factors of a civil Easter egg hunt. Oh man, this is sleepless camping. Oh, thank you. Oh, dear. I'm writing puzzles, so come join me. It's fun.
That's awesome. But we are getting towards the end of the show. So are you, you're doing a lot of writing for Geek Dad now. You're also doing science news for the Cancer Center. Do you have any ideas? I know you're kind of doing press for your current book, but do you have any directions for more geekery? Oh, yeah. Are you kid focused these days or the next book?
I happen to be kid focused. I'm coaching the kindergarten soccer team and all that good stuff, trying to herd cats. But no, I'm writing a book. The next one will be Intelligence Broadly Defined. So I'm actually interviewing people about fluid intelligence. I hate the words brain training, but I'm looking at wisdom and problem solving and practical intelligence and executive function and attention and fluid intelligence. I'm looking not just at IQ and how fluid intelligence, how you get intelligence in, but factors that allow people to get intelligence out, how we go about problem solving, what is creativity, where does it come from? And I'm trying to actually take a scientific look at it. I mean, this has been done, you know, three ways to spring by, well, I guess I won't disparage, but it's been done a couple self-helpy ways before, and I want to give it some science.
Nice.
Yeah.
I love science approaches. And I'm expecting, as usual, your flair for geek knowledge will give it a really unique taste as well.
A book without zombies is not worth writing. So somewhere,
right? Somewhere
you'll find zombies.
I love it. I love it. Garth, thank you so much for joining me again on the show. I mean, it's been a while and it's so great to see you and talk to you again and hear what you've been up to.
And hear your kids in the back, or your kid in the background coming home. So congratulations. And it is spectacular to see you.
Absolutely. And next time I'm in Boulder, I will say hi.
Look me up.
I'm in Boulder. I will. Yeah. Wait.
No, Kiki.
Which one?
Yes, Kiki. No.
But this one is valid as well.
Yes, it is. Neither one is my kind of geekery. Oh, and speaking of Boulder, that was what we call a segue. Nanu, Nanu. Indy fans.
Exactly. So everyone, if you're interested in checking out Garth's stuff, you can go to his website, garthsundam.com, and get lots more great information about science, geekery, math equations, music. That's right. We've talked about his musicianship past before, but there's a lot to be learned from Garth Sundam. So I hope you do visit his website and check out his books as well. Brain Trust is the most recent book and what we've been talking about today. I'm Dr. Kiki, and this has been the Science Hour. We're done with our hour. And next week, we're going to have more great science fun for you. And in the meantime, I hope that you look me up, follow my sciencey pursuits on the social interwebs. You can go to Twitter, Facebook. I'm Dr. Kiki. Google Plus, I'm Kiki Sanford. I'm all over these places posting and doing social media type stuff that's related to science. You can subscribe to this show if you go to twit.tv/Kiki, and you can find past episodes. And if you need even more sciencey goodness, you can catch This Week in Science, which is also on the Twit Network Thursday evenings at 7:30 p.m. Pacific time. You can go to twist.org to be able to get past episodes of that show, iTunes, whatever, RSS feed stuff. And additionally, on Fridays, I'm doing a science chat over on JustinTV/Dr. Kiki, Fridays, noon to 1 p.m. Pacific time. And now I'm trying Google Hangouts a little bit from 1 to 2 p.m. So I'm trying to democratize the science conversation. Let's get more and more people involved in it. I'll see you next week. Thank you very much for joining me this hour. And remember, all I ask is 1 hour a week, really just 1 hour a week. And I do hope that it makes your world a lot more interesting. Now for your science meditation of the week.
Yes. Oh, hey. Knock it off, dog.
And those are the pre-mating dance. That is the pre-mating dance of the African white rhino. And the rhino dance there was successful. And there are other videos available on YouTube if you are interested in observing rhino loving.